A settlement has been reached in Louisville for the killing of Breonna Taylor.
I don't think the city had a choice. I think the city had to not only settle quickly, but they had to make a historic move because our city is in complete unrest.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 16th, we break down the $12 million settlement and look at where the criminal case goes from here. Also, we talk about the allegations brought on by a whistleblower at an ICE detention facility in Georgia about hysterectomies performed on detainees. We're also talking about why animal populations are disappearing and also what possible new populations of life we could find on Venus, our neighbor planet.
All right, let's do this.
Please continue to say her name, Breonna Taylor.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. The city of Louisville, Kentucky has settled a wrongful death suit for $12 million with the family of Breonna Taylor, the 26-year-old black woman who was shot and killed by police in her apartment 6 months ago.
While we await a decision from Attorney General Daniel Cameron on whether or not charges will be filed in this case, my administration is not waiting to move ahead with needed reforms to prevent a tragedy like this from ever happening again.
That was Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher, and we're going to talk about the specifics of those police reforms in just a moment. In the meantime, Taylor's family and lawyers commended the settlement, but said yesterday that justice for Breonna will not have been served until Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron brings criminal charges against the three officers involved with her death. Here's Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, speaking at a press conference yesterday.
As significant as today is, it's only the beginning of getting full justice for Breonna. We must not lose focus on what the real job is. And with that being said, it's time to move forward with the criminal charges because she deserves that and much more. Her beautiful spirit and personality is working through all of us on the ground. So please continue to say her name, Breonna Taylor.
Joining me now to talk about this is Tessa Duval, a reporter with the Courier Journal in Louisville, and Tim Finley Jr., the senior pastor at Kingdom Fellowship in Louisville and the founder of the Justice and Freedom Coalition. Tessa and Timothy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Hello.
Tim, let's start with you. How has the settlement been received? What was your reaction to the $12 million settlement?
Well, we certainly expected there to be a settlement. That part was not surprising. It's been my sort of push just to continue allowing people to understand that this is not the end of this ordeal, that we want to see criminal charges. We want to see an indictment, and we want to be happy for the family, but we've got to see top to bottom change in our police department.
And that's one of the things we're going to talk about in a little bit, the specifics here that the city is proposing. But Tessa, the settlement on the civil suit, at least, is for $12 million. That feels, in some places, could be considered historic. How does that compare with other settlements from wrongful death suits?
Well, certainly. In Louisville, it is considered historic. This is the largest payout that is a result of police conduct here in Louisville. The previous largest amount was $8.5 million several years ago. So that is certainly a large figure in Louisville standards. In terms of national standards as well, I mean, there certainly have been bigger settlements with police departments around the country, but not many. This is about twice the amount that Eric Garner's family got, for example, or the family of Tamir Rice. So this is a truly large amount. And it's also important to note that this was settled very quickly. I mean, this lawsuit against the police officers was only filed in April. It didn't have to go to a jury trial. This was a really, really quick resolution to this lawsuit.
Tim, given the rapidity, if you will, how quickly this was settled, to Tessa's point, how much of that do you think has to do with efforts on the ground in Louisville by activists and others to bring attention to Taylor's case?
Oh, I think it has a very, very substantial point and part in all of this. There have been 100 plus days of protesting here. Celebrities, we've seen athletes who have called for justice. To be completely honest, I don't think the city had a choice. I think the city had to not only settle quickly, but they had to make a historic move because our city is in complete unrest right now. And protesters, myself and others, we have to see justice. And I think that the local leaders felt that.
Tessa, one of the things that came out of the settlement, in addition to the $12 million, were also a series of police reforms. Can you walk us through what some of those reforms are?
You know, there's some reforms coming that had already been announced about body cameras, but additional reforms about body cameras requiring that two officers wear cameras when they count money that's been seized from people. We're also seeing reforms to the search warrant process. So it has to go up the chain of command to a commanding officer before it even goes to a judge. We're also seeing that there has to be a risk assessment done before search warrants are executed. And then they're also really trying to push for officers to more deeply connect with the community. So we're seeing the encouragement of paid community service, as well as trying to get officers to actually live in some of the communities that they are assigned to work in.
When you hear about police reform, particularly under Breonna Taylor's case, and you hear one of the tenets is to increase community engagement with police and the community, do you think that's enough, or is this more of a push towards defunding and ultimately abolishing the police?
Well, I'll say I do not think that this is enough. I think that it's a small incremental step in the right direction. One of the things that was very striking to me yesterday, even hearing some of these police reform, I guess, negotiations, what came out of that, was that these seem to be common sense sort of reforms. In other words, these are things that should have been happening. And it's amazing to me that in 2020, things like drug testing, things that just should already be in place. To your question, I think what we've got to see from police departments around the country, we've got to see police officers that look like those in the community that they serve. That's something that I think is behind the thought with the, I think the housing credits in terms of getting police officers or encouraging police officers to live in those communities. But I am one that unapologetically stands for not abolishing the police, but certainly defunding the police. I have police officer friends. I have family members that are involved in law enforcement. But I do believe that we've got to learn to reallocate some of these exorbitant budgets and send those funds to community programs and to systems already in the community and help to transform these distressed communities. So I'm one that absolutely believes that we've got to have more conversation and more action around defunding the police.
Tessa, one of the key figures here as this case moves forward, of course, this is not the end. This is the civil suit, but there is still a criminal question involved here, particularly with the three officers who were involved in Taylor's death. And they have yet to face criminal charges. Attorney General Daniel Cameron is really the one who will make this decision. What do we know about Cameron and where he stands here?
Cameron is in his first term in office. He is the first Republican to hold the office of Attorney General in Kentucky in decades. He is Mitch McConnell protege, and he's been endorsed by Donald Trump.
So, and he's also African American, correct?
Correct. Yes. Yes. He is the first Black man to hold this office. So while we know that his political leanings are very conservative, very Republican, I have spoken to former attorneys general who say that, you know, this office has dedicated career prosecutors who will do the right thing, and that if Cameron is smart and holds true to what this job requires of him, he will defer to those career prosecutors who are making the decision in this case. But you're absolutely right. This settlement that we saw yesterday is only the civil suit. So Daniel Cameron's office is still looking into this, and the FBI as well. So this case is not over. While the civil suit has been settled, there's still much more to be learned about this case as a whole.
Tessa just mentioned Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who represents Kentucky, and he told reporters yesterday, quote, "The investigation seems to have been more complicated than a lot of people felt." And he, McConnell, said he has confidence in Daniel Cameron to do the right thing and stands by him. When you hear this, Tim, how did you feel about Mitch McConnell and Daniel Cameron's response to the ongoing calls for these officers to be arrested at the very least?
Well, as a lifelong Louisvillian, born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, I can say this, and I don't think I'm speaking for all Black people, but certainly the ones that I know, we don't feel or value Mitch McConnell as a friend. He has not been a friend to our community. He's been in this position for 30 plus years, the vast majority of my life. And I am very skeptical, but open-minded to Daniel Cameron, simply because of his association with Mitch McConnell. Our community is collectively holding our breath, and we're looking for Daniel Cameron to do the right thing. What sort of gives me cause to pause is the fact that he will defer to those career prosecutors. And again, there is deep-seated trust issues when it comes to the criminal justice system in the Black community. So hearing that he will lean on these career prosecutors is not always a comforting piece of news. It's not something that we look at and say, okay, well, we believe the right thing is going to happen. So that's, you know, just Mitch McConnell, we want him, you know, we know we need change in leadership in this state. But again, we're hoping, we're praying that Daniel Cameron does the right thing. And we also think that this news was a bit suspect as well, him being on the short list for the Supreme Court justice, the fact that he was turning it over to the grand jury, all of these things, it just, again, further causes a bit of trepidation when it comes to the right thing being done.
And that trepidation, Tim, just so I'm clear, is because I just want to make sure I'm understanding your point here, is that he's sort of being courted by the more conservative Republican Party right now, and as a result of that may have more allegiance to that party, may make decisions based on political affiliation versus criminality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, you know, there are so many sayings about the company that you keep. Well, being the protege of Mitch McConnell, being courted by Donald Trump, that is 100% an issue for people in my community.
Timothy Finley Jr. is the senior pastor at Kingdom Fellowship in Louisville and the founder of the Justice and Freedom Coalition. And Tessa Duval is a reporter with the Courier-Journal in Louisville. Timothy, Tessa, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I was called in one day and I was demoted. And I know I was demoted because I raised questions about why. I was told not to tell officers that there were detainees that they dealt with day in and day out that were positive.
That was Dawn Wooten, a nurse at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia, who filed a whistleblower complaint this week alleging, quote, high rates of hysterectomies at times without proper informed consent. The complaint also alleges extensive neglect for COVID-19 safety protocols at the detention center, including a lack of testing for the virus and insufficient personal protective equipment for detainees and employees. Project South is the legal advocacy group that filed the complaint, spoke with multiple detainees at the Irwin County Detention Center, as well as the whistleblower, about the hysterectomies. According to the detainees in Wooten, a number of women had been sent by officials at the facility to the same gynecologist and could have received hysterectomies that they were unsure were medically necessary. John Washington is a freelance reporter and the author of The Dispossessed, and Jose Olivares is an associate producer with us here at The Takeaway. John and Jose, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
John, you spoke to several Irwin detainees this week about these hysterectomies. What did they tell you? Were these people who had actually gotten the hysterectomies?
Right. So I think it's absolutely critical to couch these procedures in the larger context of medical neglect and medical abuse that is at crisis levels in this and other immigration detention centers. But the women that we spoke to specifically about the hysterectomies did not receive them, but they were told that they needed to receive them, and they didn't understand why. They also told us about a number of other women that did receive them, and nobody explained to them what the procedure was going to be, what exactly it would entail, and what the results of the procedure would be. A couple of them pushed back, and one of them said that the doctor became angry after she didn't want the procedure done, and nobody explained to them the follow-up care that they were going to receive either. All three women were absolutely angry and indignant about the situation. One of the women was weeping, and I think that it's really important to understand that the women who did receive hysterectomies have been difficult to find. Some of them have been deported. Some of them also were telling the women that they didn't understand why they had received these operations.
Jose, you talked to the doctor who performed the procedures on these detainees. What was his response to these allegations?
Yeah, so I spoke with a doctor, his name is Mahendra Amin, yesterday, and essentially he himself is an immigrant who is a gynecologist in a smaller hospital in southern Georgia, very close to where the Irwin County Detention Center lies. And what we know about him is that in the past, he has sort of come under fire from the U.S. government on allegations of some Medicaid fraud in terms of some situations that were happening. I mean, that case was settled and there was never really any real culpability that was found, but he did have to pay over $500,000 to the federal government for these allegations for the settlement. And essentially, when I spoke with him on the phone yesterday, he did confirm that he was the doctor who was performing gynecological procedures on women who came from the Irwin County Detention Center, this ICE facility. He did confirm that with me, but he was very evasive in speaking with me. Essentially, he told me that he's only done around one or two hysterectomies in the past couple of years, but he did not specify whether those hysterectomies were for women detained in Irwin. He also then essentially told me that what needs to happen is he makes a medical diagnosis, he recommends what procedure or what should be done, and then ICE and the Irwin County Detention Center sign off and approve any procedure that needs to take place. And then he quickly hung up the phone on me.
Do we know, John, how many women have had these hysterectomies and whether they were aware of the hysterectomies being performed? Was this, you made some pretty strong claims at the top saying that this is about medical abuse at detention centers, but what do we know in terms of the percentage of women who have received these and whether or not they were aware or medically necessary?
We don't have a hard number. Part of the difficulty is lack of access to talking to these women. Even their advocates and attorneys have difficulty. One very clear example of that is that yesterday, the day after we published our first report on medical abuses, their system of communication was cut off from the inside, so they could not make, it was more difficult for them to make calls to the outside. But the numbers that we have are not hard. We've heard a number of estimates from both the whistleblower Don Wooten, advocates, and a couple of the detainee women that we have spoken with. And the number that got thrown out a couple times was 20 or more than 20. That was according to Don Wooten. In the past 6 years, a couple of the detainee women cited a similar number within even a shorter time frame.
Why does that number stand out? I guess I'm trying to understand, Jose, if you know anything here, please weigh in terms of the overall percentage of hysterectomies that are conducted at immigration detention centers. Is that a high number, a low number? Can you help us understand in context?
That's why people are calling for an investigation. That's why Pelosi has also called for an investigation, because we really don't know at what rate this is happening or if this is happening in other detention centers. What one attorney from the Southern Poverty Law Center pointed out to me yesterday is that she was really surprised at how ICE and the Irwin County Detention Center were signing off on gynecological procedures that she says may not have been entirely necessary, but how ICE and the Irwin County Detention Center were dragging their feet in providing masks to detainees, drag their feet when it comes to refilling inhalers, drag their feet when it comes to other medical emergency situations that could potentially be life-saving. And so that's something that also strikes advocates as odd, is seeing the disparity in the way ICE is treating gynecological procedures as opposed to other important, also important healthcare situations.
The allegations here is that ICE is prioritizing hysterectomies over personal protective equipment for COVID-19. Is that the point that you're making?
It's a question that advocates really want answered, is why are we seeing this disparity, and who exactly is making the call for these, for this situation?
What has ICE had to say about this, John?
Well, they cite an impending lawsuit, and they say that they cannot comment on any complaints that are filed to the Office of Inspector General. So they have been pretty evasive about answering clearly the question. They have responded to a couple other reporters, however, citing that there have only been, I believe it was 2 hysterectomies done, and that they are ensuring that, you know, all necessary medical care is provided to women. But they haven't really been responding.
Jose, what do we know about the whistleblower herself, Nurse Wooten?
So Dawn Wooten, she is someone who has worked at the facility for a few years, kind of on and off. She essentially is a nurse who worked in the facility, worked with the detained population, and she herself has health problems. She has 5 children. She's a single mother, and she's been doing this work with detainees. But what she started noticing, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, is just the lack of protection and what she alleges was neglect and callousness by management in the facility when it came to dealing with detained populations who were very much at risk and who are still at risk of contracting COVID-19 and getting the virus. So essentially what she did is she herself began, you know, speaking up at work, recommending that staff and detainees follow the CDC recommendations for social distancing. She began very much speaking out against management when they would refuse to test detainees, when they would refuse to provide treatment to folks who were exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19. And as a result, she was unfortunately demoted, and she, in a way that she sees and she alleges is retaliation for having spoken up internally. And so she's still technically employed by the facility, but she was demoted from being a full-time nurse at the facility to now being only on call or part-time. And she's only been receiving a few hours a month since early July. And this has been a huge economic blow to her. I mean, especially with the 5 kids that she has and making car and rent payments, this demotion and this, you know, drastic cut of hours, which she sees as retaliation, has really kind of affected her and her personal life. And so it eventually got to a breaking point where she said, I can't take this anymore. I think what is happening is unjust. And she decided to speak out and blow the whistle on conditions in detention.
John, what happens now?
Well, a number of people are calling for further investigation. The Irwin County Detention Center is certainly being scrutinized in a different way by other reporters. Both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have called for investigations. A Georgia State representative has called for the doctor's license being suspended and an investigation into that specific claim of the hysterectomies. But I think it's really important to keep shining a light on what's going on, for people like Dawn Wooten to be able to speak out, to be protected when they do, and for a lot of both journalists and then just American people to try to understand and try to pay attention to what's happening. There's been a smokescreen for a long time over the conditions in these detention centers, and the more we hear from not only detainees or former detainees and advocates, but about people themselves working in them, like Dawn Wooten, about the shocking conditions, the more we are able to push for change and push for letting people out, for example, with who are susceptible to the coronavirus.
Jose Olivares is associate producer at The Takeaway, and John Washington is a freelance reporter. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here. host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so we talk a lot about humans on this show for good reason, but we're going to take a little trip out of the human-run world and talk about our friends in the animal kingdom for a minute. And as we all know, wild animals play all kinds of important roles in keeping the ecosystems we depend on healthy. Bats and bees and earthworms, whales and sharks, they're all part of a complex environmental weave. But it's become harder and harder for animal populations to exist at optimal levels as human activity like agriculture encroaches on their space and human-fueled climate change drastically alters their habitats. Now, a new report from the Worldwide Fund for Nature shows that animal populations have fallen 68% in the past 50 years. I asked Eric Rostin about this. He's a climate reporter at Bloomberg Green.
The 2020 WWF Living Planet report documents a 68% decline in the population of vertebrate animals since 1970. So that includes birds and amphibians, mammals, reptiles, and fish as well.
When you say we, you mean humans, of course.
I do. The report, which was written by dozens of authors in conjunction with both the WWF and the Zoological Society of London, documents that it's human consumption, the systems that make our economy go globally, are really having this catastrophic effect on animal populations. The biggest challenge is addressing how we use the land. Deforestation is a huge driver of these population declines, and converting that virgin forest to agriculture not only leads to about half of the overall declines that the scientists are seeing, but it's also a major contributor to climate change as well.
As communities get larger and larger and people are looking for places to build, we seem to be building, housing and other developments on land that animals once lived on. Is that partly to blame, or is it really more industrial land use that's partly to blame?
It's both, but you're absolutely right that the whole planet is urbanizing. And as a result of that, we're seeing the destruction of these forest ecosystems. And there's a number of reasons why this is a problem. One of the problems that are front of mind is that as the forest ecosystems decline, animals that had lived within it and carried around viruses that lived just within these niches in faraway communities, they're now free to go out into the world. And as it happens, the animals that adapt most effectively to living in cities and other human communities, those are also the ones that are best at transmitting viruses, so bats and rodents. So there's a number of truly problematic issues sort of thrown in with this network of problems related to biodiversity loss. The pandemic is one of them.
I'm wondering also, you mentioned some of the categories of animals. Can we talk a little bit more specifically about what kinds of animals
beyond just broader categories? Are there specific species or types of birds, for example, or other mammals that are feeling this more so than other types of animals? Are there animals that we're more familiar with?
Well, many of them are animals we're familiar with. The group of animals that have the single biggest impact are freshwater animals. So that's fish and the birds that live off of freshwater communities around the world. Those have seen an 84% drop in animal populations. So that's largely fish and birds since 1970. It's the largest single decline of any particular kind of ecosystem around the world. So in addition to the problems we see from land use change, I mean, there's pollution, there's pesticides from farming that ends up in places it shouldn't be and poisons communities. There's industrial metals that find their way to these sensitive communities. And of course, there's also, you know, just kind of overfishing and poaching of animals that should not be occurring if we're going to keep these ecosystems healthy. The scientists definitely emphasize that that's the overall goal here, is to keep these ecosystems healthy. The reasons that's important, in addition to what I mentioned a second ago about pandemics, is ecosystems quietly and persistently for the entire breadth of human history have been doing the quiet, hard work of cleaning our air and cleaning our water, making sure that soil stays where it is and that soils regenerate so that we can continue to grow food. Those ecosystem services, which we pay nothing for and also pay little attention to, are absolutely critical for economic and human health. So declines in animal populations are a true red flag for threats to these systems we rely on without much thought to it.
You mentioned coronavirus, COVID-19. What effect has that had on the animal population that we understand so far? How has that played into all of this?
The scientists would say in response to that question that, well, the monitoring that goes into these animal populations globally is so onerous and takes so much time to amass the data that goes into the report that they actually closed the observation for this report, I believe, in something on 2016. And then it takes a little while to process all of the data into the aggregate levels that they see. On a more sort of anecdotal level, it's more evidence than anecdotal. Some of the most startling images we've seen from the pandemic are the evacuation of people from cities and other built environments, and the return of animals to these areas. So it's not, you know, a sort of robust, highly desirable way for nature to heal. But it does provide a glimpse at as soon as human behavior changes on a large scale, it opens up niches for animals and ecosystems to come back and figure out new ways to live once the harm that we do to them dissipates.
Eric Roston is climate reporter at Bloomberg Green. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're going to end today's show by moving away from life on Earth to possible life on the planet next door. On Monday, scientists announced they've detected the gas called phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. Here on Earth, phosphine is a toxic gas that's made by microorganisms, and so the presence of phosphine in Venus's clouds means there's a chance that life could be there too. But we're not talking about the aliens we see on movies and TV. We're talking about tiny microbial life forms. And though it's too early to say that life does indeed exist on Venus, scientists have yet to find any other explanation for why the gas phosphine is present. For more on this, we're joined now by Dr. Martha Gilmore, a planetary geologist and professor at Wesleyan University. Martha, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So as someone who studied the planet Venus, were you surprised by this finding?
Oh, certainly. We're always surprised to find evidence of life elsewhere. And also the surprise is in the fact that the signal, potential signal for life, was detected in the clouds. Since we have so far, we think about life as being related to surfaces, planetary surfaces. And so it expands our horizons to think that perhaps the clouds of Venus or Earth or another planet might be a niche for life.
Now, we mentioned at the top, we're not talking about aliens, and as much as people may want to imagine, you know, flying saucers and things like that, we're not there yet. We're talking about tiny little particles, aren't we? When we say life, what do we mean?
Yeah, I mean, we all probably think of Lando Calrissian and the Cloud City, and that's probably not what's happening.
right?
Although that would be great. whatever life lives in the clouds in particular has to take advantage of what's available to it. And to live in the cloud, you need to be small enough to probably adhere to a droplet, to be able to take in water and other nutrients that you need. And on Earth, the microbes that we see in the clouds of the Earth, which do not spend their entire life cycle, but some of them hang out there for a little while, are lifted up from the Earth's surface. They're small enough to be carried by the winds and the clouds. And so our expectation is that it must be small because it needs to be buoyant and float and take advantage of the materials available to it in the cloud.
We talked a little bit about a gas called phosphine. What is it? And I understand it doesn't smell too great.
Yeah, we all started by looking up, what is phosphine?
So we're not alone. This is encouraging to know. Okay.
No, this is it's a nerve agent. It's actually very difficult to work with. It is the reason why cops have to be careful going into crystal meth labs, because it is one of the things that is produced with crystal meth.
What's happening on Venus, Doctor?
I know, really. So that's a whole other story. It's a simple molecule. It is phosphorus with three hydrogens. And this is a gas. And so one of the reasons why this is a compelling gas for biota is because the things that life needs, as far as we know, to exist, there are several elements: carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus. And phosphorus is strange. Your teeth are made. Our teeth are made of phosphorus. It's a pretty important element, but it's derived from rock. And so life has to somehow find a way to pull the phosphorus out of rock to use it for its life cycle. Phosphine is a gas, and so it offers the opportunity to provide phosphorus for potential life that live in a gas phase.
About a little more than 50 years ago, scientists, including Carl Sagan, had speculated that life would exist in Venus's clouds. But a lot of that attention, at least in the past couple of decades, has really been on Mars. What's happening on Mars? Should we go to Mars? Is Mars inhabitable or not? Did we overlook Venus?
Well, Mars is wonderful because of its thin atmosphere. We can see the morphological evidence of rivers and deltas. For example, what the Mars 2020 is on its way to a delta in an ancient lake. So we can measure the mineralogy from orbit. We can see the processes associated with water. Venus is harder in that way because its thick cloud cover prevents us from using conventional methods like visible light to look at the surface. So that's coupled with the fact that the Venus surface itself is, as far as we know, pretty uninhabitable. It's 450 degrees Celsius. It is, that's pretty much all you need to say, actually.
A little too hot for me, personally.
It's too hot. It's too hot for water. And water is one of the building blocks for liquid water for life. So it's been overlooked as an astrobiological target, but a couple things have changed in the last couple decades. One is the appreciation of life that spends some of its life cycle in the clouds, as I mentioned before, on Earth. And also the rise of the discovery of so many exoplanets around the galaxy, which was the impetus for this study by Greaves. They were trying to tune some of their telescopes to be able to look at the clouds of other planets. And Venus is the one example where we can both look at the light coming from the atmosphere, which is what we can detect at exoplanets, but we can also visit it because it's right next door. So mm-hmm. we can then compare what we measure inside the atmosphere, if we go on a mission, to what we see on the top of the atmosphere. And what exoplanet scientists want to learn is, what are the signatures of the atmosphere of a habitable or inhabited planet? And phosphine now enters that list of potential compounds that could indicate life.
Martha, we've got about a minute left, but I just want to ask you, does this indicate that there could be life on other planets potentially?
Well, I hope so. Every discovery we make at another planet forces us to reconsider the origin of life on the Earth, which we still don't understand. We know that life exists in the universe. We're right here, but we still don't have the basic understanding of how Earth went from a lifeless planet to one that is teeming with life. And so the discovery of how organic materials on other planets, how they can come together to take advantage of the environment particular to that planet, is going to tell us a lot about how life evolves in general.
We'll pay attention to that. Dr. Martha Gilmore is a planetary geologist and professor at Wesleyan University. Martha, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.